You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Hi there, Chris. How did it feel to play a Scottish legend, and what kind of pressure comes with playing a Scotsman, the Scottish accent, swearing the right way?
Well, I figured I would be crucified by some people, so I kind of gave up trying to be a perfect Scotsman early on. I had an incredible dialect coach. I worked with mainly Scottish men in the largest fraternity of mean actors of all time. And they were brutally honest with me and kept me in line. And I lived in Glasgow for, I don't know, 4 months and just tried to soak up as much as I could. And in terms of playing Robert the Bruce, it's a challenge I couldn't turn down. And the man is 600 some odd years old, and in order to pin down who this guy was is a bit more difficult than I thought, so I tried to do justice to the script that was given to me and the character that I saw on the page.
Well, thank you very much. We thought your Scottish accent was great, so there you go.
Thank you very much.
Well, hello and welcome to the 602 Club. I am so excited to be here. I hope that you like scotch, because that is all that Ruby is serving tonight, which is fine with me. And I have with me the one and only Scotsman that I know personally, the fantastic Lee Hutchinson. How's it going, Lee?
Yeah, really good. I'm so glad that whiskey's on the menu today. So it feels very fitting for our conversation today.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. Luckily, she's only serving the good stuff, so 18 years and above, which is fantastic as well. With all of this Scottish talk, maybe people have figured out what we're going to talk about. But recently, at least in the States, we had a film released on Netflix called Outlaw King, which stars the one and only Chris Pine. And Lee, you got to see this in the theater, though, because you went to the premiere, correct?
Yeah, well, to an extent, yeah. I got to go to the London Film Festival, and I got to watch an 8:30 in the morning press screening on the largest IMAX screen in the country. So it's certainly a bit different from kind of many people's experience of this movie. We've been kind of lucky here in the UK, really, in the past kind of year or so, an independent cinema chain has been getting a bit of a deal with Netflix movies, but it never really comes north of the border. But we've been really lucky with this being sort of a Scottish movie that mm-hmm. We've also got the option to kind of see it in the cinema for a week here in Scotland and in only two cinemas. So I've certainly had my choices to see this movie.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I can definitely see, you know, after having seen the film, it would have been nice to have seen this on the big screen. But before we get completely off track, I just want to remind everybody, of course, you know, you can find the 602 Club wherever you get your podcasts. I mean, seriously, wherever you find podcasts, whatever podcast catcher you're using, you can look us up and subscribe there. Of course, if you're over on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, you know, hit us up with a star rating review. I know we say it every time, but it's totally true. It helps people find the show. It helps the show grow. It helps more people see the show because it makes it more visible in iTunes. So, you get thanked whenever you do. Anybody that's ever written a star rating, given us a star rating and review, that written review, we read out what you say on the show. So, you can also find us all over the place on social media. Trek FM is everywhere. We've got the listeners only discussion group on Facebook called the Babel Conference, which allows you to talk to fans from all over the world listening to our shows. Find that on Facebook, type Babel into the search field there, or if you happen to be on the website at trek.fm, you can click discussion on any of the show pages, and that would also get you into the group. You can find us on Twitter at Trek FM. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. And last but not least, if you happen to be over on the website at trek.fm perusing things, maybe you want to send us an email. So you can do that by going to trek.fm/contact, choose a show, and choose the 602 Club. And then that email comes to me and any host that's on that week, and we'll be able to talk to you about anything that you're excited about. So, you know, Lee, I think that, you know, we were talking a little bit before we kind of got completely started, but this idea, you know, this film finally coming out, and, you know, obviously all of us are familiar with Braveheart and the story of William Wallace now because of the film that Mel Gibson did. But I felt like this was really interesting that the Bruce, you know, finally gets his due in some way to get a film of his own. Because, you know, he's such an important part of Scottish history and the first king of Scotland. What fascinated me was the fact that this film hadn't been made before. Like, nobody had told this story like this. And I was wondering if you had any idea or had any thoughts of why do you think it took so long for there to be a film like this and for this story to make it to the big screen?
I think it's one of these ones that I think you kind of look at movies of the kind of past few years and really kind of past 20 years. It's all about name recognition. And I think it's easier to kind of sell a movie where it's like, it's the Iron Man, it's the Batman, these types of characters. And it's a big risk to take on a hero for someone in Scotland, which is still a really small country, despite our influence on the world of creating TV, for example. We are still a real small country. So I think the idea of a Robert the Bruce movie going around the world, I can imagine some studios going, is this going to be something that we can put into the cinemas and people are going to know, are going to recognize? And I think that that's probably always been over their head. And I think as well, Scotland at the moment, we're really blessed with things like Outlander. We've recently had the Avengers Infinity War. We've got so much talent kind of coming into the country just now and filming. And I feel that sort of that momentum is really kind of carried through into something like, you know, Outlaw King, where people are like, yeah, we can make this film in Scotland now. You know, Braveheart, this famous Scottish movie, was pretty much all shot across the sea in Ireland. So I think now that there's more of an infrastructure, there's the talent here to make this. I mean, apart from obviously Chris Pine and a few of the cast, this is a nearly an entire Scottish production and team involved in it. So I think it's been something that's been building for a while and it's just kind of come at the right moment. So that's kind of my feeling on it.
It's funny to me that it would take so long to tell this kind of story, just because it is the kind of story that we go to the movies for, you know, the underdog versus the top dog. You know, I mean, when you're looking at what the story is about, a person struggling to be king in a country that you know, hasn't had a king in a long time. And has always been, and has been subjugated for the most part by England for a long time. You know, this is the kind of story I think we all love. And so I'm really glad that it got made. Two, I think it's just a fascinating part of history here. You know, I you know, would say it this way. Many times we see England as being the heroes in stories. And this is an interesting part of their history where you get to see England from the other side. You know, we got that picture a little bit in Braveheart, obviously. But I think that this brings it even farther just to see that, you know, there's good and bad to countries, right? You know, and I think history is so much more complex than just good and bad people anyway. And I think this really brings that to light, and it creates a really fascinating story to see. And, you know, for me personally, being somebody who has always, you know, I love Scotland, even though I've never not gotten to go, but its history fascinates me. Its whiskey fascinates me. Its landscape fascinates me. And so I think you're absolutely right. I'm kind of glad that this film didn't get made before, because, you know, using the landscape of Scotland the way that it is done here, and really getting to be in that place, I think makes such a big difference in this movie, because it makes it feel so much more real when you watch it. And I, for me, that's something I really appreciated. And in many ways, I'm kind of glad that now the Bruce can get his due when we can actually film the movie in Scotland.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the ones that I really particularly enjoyed that. And I saw it in London, you know, the heart of England. And when I was kind of watching it with fellow kind of critics and so on, and talking with people, and kind of the reaction of kind of, you know, I live in Edinburgh, it's a very mixed city in terms of Scots and English. And people are watching this movie going, I really hate the English coming out of this. And this is coming from English people. They're looking at that going, God, we come across really, really badly in this movie. Their behavior isn't exactly the most, well-behaved in this movie. So it's one of these ones that we were having a debate where it's like, you know, Thanos has, you know, clicked his fingers and killed half the universe. And then in this, you know, you've got the English come along and they went, it's almost like, hold your beer, Thanos. We've got this kind of covered. We're going for the ultimate bad guys this year. There's a real kind of pantomime element to it, but I think it kind of makes it all the more sort of enjoyable to an extent.
Well, and I think, you know, the movie does, I think, the best job that it can with a very large story. You know, I actually got a chance to read a book by Ronald McNair Scott called Robert the Bruce, and it's his whole life story, and the struggle that he has with England lasts pretty much his entire life. And so the period in which we get here is a rather short period, and there's actually a lot of things that are very condensed in the story, where they've kind of taken some liberties to give us as much of the story as they can, and yet the entire story, this is something that is so big and takes place over his entire life. And so I thought that, especially looking back at the history of it, you know, this is a period of history that this is happening all over the known world at this point, between different countries. I mean, England and it's the Netherlands, and you've got France, and of course Scotland, and all of these places, that all of this stuff is the back and forth of armies and treaties, and all this stuff is happening a lot. But on top of that, I think one of the most interesting things for me was, you know, this movie shows the way in which Robert the Bruce makes the decision. And I thought it was interesting the way they do this, because, you know, the movie makes it seem as though the Bruce decides to basically take it to Edward and sue and you know, work for Scottish freedom because of what is done to William Wallace. William Wallace finally being captured and then tortured in London, and then his body parts are like strewn across the four corners of England and Scotland to show what happens, which is, I think, it makes for a good motivation. But it's really interesting because the actual history is quite different.
Yeah, and one thing I kind of with this, like, Robert the Bruce isn't sort of one of these stories that we kind of get told a lot really in school. And it's kind of funny that you're talking about that you've just read this kind of book about, you know, my first king, as it essentially were. Whereas at school, I spent a year learning about American history and kind of the rise to American Civil War, the Civil War over. Like, there never is much kind of conversation about kind of Scottish history out with certain things like the Jacobites and perhaps, you know, the classic World Wars, for example. So, like, it's really interesting to almost have this discussion, but we're perhaps almost living in a bit of ignorance here in kind of Scotland about sort of the history. If you want to become a bit of an expert on Robert the Bruce, you need to go out and get the books. You need to go out and kind of engage with the history. It's not something that's kind of presented to you really on a plate here. And, you know, I think a lot of people in this country, for better or worse, see something like Braveheart and take it almost as a gospel. And I wonder if that's going to be perhaps the case with Outlaw King in terms of its history, for example, and what it presents, if people just go, yeah, I'm sure there's one or two inaccuracies, but yeah, I'll accept it for what it is.
See, and that's just fascinating to me, this idea that, you know, this wouldn't be something that Scots would, I mean, really be into and like have gotten taught in school, because the story of the reason that the Bruce decides to start this rebellion against England is that he and John Comyn have actually entered a pact when it looks like Edward I is going to die. He's very ill. They think he's going to die, and therefore they make a pact together. They write letters back and forth about this idea that, okay, one of us is going to be king, and whoever decides to be king, the other will give up his lands to the other person that gets to be king. And so the pact is that John Comyn decides, I want to be king, so I'll give you my lands, and we'll make our move once Edward is dead. Well, unfortunately for them, Edward gets better. He's not quite dead, and at that point, actually, too, you have the Bruce in England, and he realizes that something is fishy, like something's going on, like the king is treating him weirdly. And he flees, making his way back to Scotland. They actually run into the guy that John Comyn has sent with letters to the King of England, Edward, to let him know about this treachery, spinning it that it's all, you know, the Bruce's fault. So the Bruce becomes an outlaw, basically. That's how that happens. Like, he becomes the person that the King of England is trying to hunt down, and therefore doesn't have as much of a choice in the matter, because the person he had entered a pact with to go against Edward has betrayed him. And so it's fascinating to me. Like, I get the fact that you simplify it for the movie, but I was reading the history and I was like, this is so much more intriguing than what they put in the movie.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating as well, because there's like what we kind of see perhaps in the movie and what we're discussing there. Yet English historical records almost have a slightly different take on it, that he was going to kill Comyn all along so he could gain the throne. So they go from sort of the more salacious and drama side of it than perhaps the side that we think, well, that does probably make more sense. You know, there's more kind of motives going on here and betrayal and, mm-hmm. you know, betrayal of betrayals going on. So yeah, it's certainly interesting. It's almost that kind of classic, you know, history is written by the victor.
Yeah, and I mean, that, at least according to what I had read, you know, that is the reason that the Bruce then he doesn't even murder him. He stabs him. They are leaving, and one of his men is like, shouldn't we finish the job? And he goes in, and one of his guys goes in and kills him. So, I mean, it is fascinating, but he has that confrontation because he is confronting him about the fact that he knows for certain that Comyn has turned on him. So it just makes for this really interesting history. And like you said, there's all these back and forth, these betrayals of betrayals and all that kind of stuff. And it really is very, it's so much more detailed and so much more fascinating, really, when you look at how history plays itself out. But one of the things that I was kind of interested in was the fact that, you know, and it reminded me a little bit of Star Trek Into Darkness, where, you know, Khan is saying to Kirk, you know, is there anything you would not do for your family? And in many ways, you know, the story we kind of see here is that the Bruce does this for his country, like the entire country of Scotland, but he also does it for his own family as well. And what he's willing to give up is a lot, because he spends so much of his life in the open, out in the wild with his army, and they're willing to burn down their own castles. And you know, here's a man of extreme privilege at this point, willing to sacrifice pretty much everything he owns and everything he has for this desire to free Scotland, you know. And I think that's an interesting and fascinating story to me, the guy that would be willing to basically give up money and title in that way, land, which in that point is what makes you rich. He's willing to destroy it all and burn it all down, which he does. Because every time they capture a castle, he'll burn it down so that the English can't use it again. That's just, I mean, by today's standards, that's kind of crazy. but it's also what wins them today in the end.
Yeah, and I think it's even the same kind of at the beginning where he sort of falls into line with England because that's what his father wants, that he has to agree with what his kind of father wants. So he is willing to kind of sacrifice that. Even you see it all along in those kind of first meetings between the Bruce and Edward and, you know, the Prince of Wales, where you can see this is a guy that is, you know, raging inside about this deal, but he's getting into line because that's what his father wants and that's what he believes he has to do. You know, it's, you know, they're almost put into a surrender. He's almost giving up at that point as well. So it feels so consistent that he's always kind of, that's his default position, that he is always willing to sacrifice something for the greater good, for either family, you know, in terms of his father's choices. And I think it shows him as a noble and very consistent man as well. He's not someone where you see it in many superhero moments where, or, you know, traditional moments like that, where you think this is a guy that is, you know, he's, you know, a normal person, but then something happens that shatters all of that. You kind of get that feeling just straight away that this is a man that is ready to turn, that he is always going to be consistent in that respect. He will always do the right thing at that time.
Well, and I like that too, because, you know, look, obviously it's politically motivated for him because he does want to be king, but he also wants to do what he believes is right for his people, which is to not be subjugated by England, which is that they should be free. They should have the freedom to reign them, you know, to rule over themselves. You know, and the fact that, you know, he sets up too, historically, you know, he sets up a parliament very much in the same line as England. So yes, he is king, but he is not tyrant. And not only that, but I also think it's really fascinating too, reading the history, not only is he willing to give all this up, but the one of his main supporters is the church there in Scotland, supporting him and backing him. Because of course, in that time, you know, if you don't have the support of the church, you don't have anything. So they put their money on Robert the Bruce as well. And I thought that this was really interesting. You know, I think in a world in which we live where everybody is wanting to, you know, support some cause or whatever, to see a man be willing to support his cause with every single ounce of everything that he has and is, I think that is a real testament to what it takes to change the world. Like, if you want to change the world, you have to be willing to sacrifice everything. And the Bruce is willing to do that.
Absolutely. I really found the you know, the work that was kind of going on with the church, where he goes to them, that he is appealing to them that, you know, if you come with me, you know, the Church of Scotland will be still kind of, it will have its place in this world in Scotland. Whereas if it kind of continues the way it is, then it will be essentially replaced by the Church of England. And I find that quite fascinating to see, you know, the church leaders playing politics with this as well. They are, you know, this man is, you know, he has just committed murder, but they are willing to support him and back him for the long-term good, that they can see that falling in line with him is going to be the best for the church in the long term. And I really found that moment where you see them discussing the politics of it all, and they're so sure of what they need to do, there doesn't seem to be much debate. I thought that was quite an interesting thing, and something I've rarely ever seen perhaps in a film. Often it can be done in a bit of a sort of the religious characters are sort of kind of, you know, they're very kind of caricatures. With this, they felt kind of, you know, you could understand their decisions here, and you could see why they would essentially support a murderer in this case.
Well, and I think it goes to show you that, like you said, the church isn't just this kind of like caricature. You know, that the importance of and the reality of, you know, I remember even listening to an interview with Chris Pine, and he was talking about this idea. You know, this is a time period where the church plays just as much into the realities of life as everything else. You know, and he said, you know, this is also a point where people truly believe you know, in the church. They truly believe in God, and therefore it's highly important to them to have the backing of the church. Otherwise, they don't have anything. And so, like, even historically, as I was reading the book, you know, there are a couple of times in the Bruce's life where even though the church absolves him, he still will make, he makes certain pilgrimages to certain places, burial place of some certain saints, to again ask for absolution. So it's not as though even that one moment he feels okay with himself. Like, it is something that kind of seems to continue on in his life, where he feels the need to ask for absolution again. So I feel like this is a man who, you know, he commits that act, but it's not something where he just walked away from it and he was fine. I think that speaks to the character of the man pretty deeply.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as almost as soon as that knife has come out of John Common, he is immediately like, all right, I need to go. And, you know, he is very clear almost in the process, like before he's even gone to Common, you can see the process. And he said, if I do this, I need to do this, I need to do that. Like, you know, there is a clear thought process behind everything. And he is aware in that moment that he could go to the church leaders and they could say, you know, you are a murderer, and he could be hung the next day. He is taking a huge gamble on that, even kind of going through the church, you know, but he has to do it. And, you know, it's a gamble that essentially pays off both for the kind of Church of Scotland and for the Bruce.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right. You think about that, you know, the whole idea of he's gambling with his soul at that point, because for him, if he doesn't get the absolution, you know, murderers, you know, without absolution from the church, get sent to hell. You know, so I mean, like, this is he is willing to sacrifice everything for what he believes is the best for Scotland, and he believes himself to be what's best for Scotland. And what I think is really interesting, you know, I was reading another book recently, and they were talking about the ways in which, you know, certain men of power don't necessarily always lay that power down. And that's one of the things that made George Washington kind of unique in that sense, is that he has the opportunity to basically be king, and he lets that power go. And, you know, the Bruce has the power then to be the ultimate ruler of Scotland, and yet he doesn't take it upon himself to be any kind of tyrant in the end. He creates a form of government, which, yes, there's a king, but there's a parliament to rule alongside. And I think that speaks really highly to him. It wasn't just about the power for him. It really truly seemed to be about the freedom for his people. And I think, you know, that's maybe something that we have lost in our political society today all over the world. So,
yeah, and I think there's a great moment just towards sort of the last stretch of the movie before the big payoff battle, where someone's like, where is the Bruce? And like, he's looking around, you know, expecting him to sort of be what we'd expect from a leader, you know, viewing things from afar. But there he is in the trenches, digging up the mud and having a sing song with his, you know, fellow man. And I thought that was a great moment. It sums up why, you know, someone like Robert the Bruce could achieve what he did. He could get men to fight alongside him, and he fought with them. He wasn't someone that ruled by fear, because that's what was essentially going on with the English. He needed to be different, and he was different, and that was where many of his success came from.
No, I really like that you bring that up, because I think that is probably the most important part of the movie, and it's one of the keys that, you know, as I was reading the history for the Bruce, it is he's a man who is a man of the people. You know, in that sense, like his men follow him because there's nothing he would ask them to do that he doesn't do himself. And many of the times he's leading the charge into battle, like you said, just being he's another guy in the trenches digging up in the mud. It's again, it's one of those things where it just shows you the character of the man. And I think that's something that, you know, you look at that and it does make you long. I think that's why people long for the good old days when they see things like this. They're just like, man, we need more people that think and act like this. So I think that's a good moment. You know, we've talked a lot about kind of the history and everything, but I wanted to ask you specifically, I mean, you know, a Chris Pine. How do you think he does in this role? Because I mean, this is a big chunk to chew. You know, like this is a big thing to try and pull off. One, you've got to try and do the accent right, right? You know, and two, just I mean, this is a role that will define what people think of as Robert the Bruce in many of the ways that, you know, Mel Gibson's role, that's what people think of William Wallace. And you want to do that justice for an entire country.
Yeah, and I think he did it really well. I've heard no complaints from Scottish people, and we love to complain, trust me on that one. If anyone murders a Scottish
actor, it's awful.
Everyone has an opinion on an actor whenever they do a Scottish accent, but he is getting the thumbs up. And for me, I was having this discussion with someone the other day, and the point was someone had said, why in this kind of Scottish movie that is nearly an entire Scottish cast, Scottish production team, do you have an American as your Scottish kind of hero? And kind of my view of it was, like, I thought Chris Pine was an inspired choice because, you know, I think he's fantastic in Star Trek, you know, Wonder Woman, Hell or High Water. But for me, I can almost describe it on a personal kind of level. So we kind of mentioned earlier on, I was at sort of the press screening, but at the nighttime, I was really lucky enough to be on the red carpet kind of posing questions of the cast and crew. And there was talk all week, you know, these were the people coming, but it hadn't been confirmed that Chris Pine was there. But he was in London, I knew that, so I thought he's bound to be there. And I remembered at one point when I first saw him with my eyes, I mean, I've known this guy for about maybe 10 years on TV and film. And I remember just looking down the red carpet and I clocked eyes with him. And you're just immediately taken back. And I mean, I'm lucky that I've been to conventions, I've been to red carpets where I see famous actors a lot of the time. And it's like, oh, that's that person. But with Chris Pine, he had a real presence that you were like, oh, wow. Like, he's quite a tall guy. And then when he talks, he's very personable. He interacts with people really well. And you kind of get this feeling of going, if I was David McKenzie and I was working with this guy in Hell or High Water, I'd be looking at him, and probably in the way that J.J. Abrams and co, when they were casting Star Trek, would look at him and go, this is, he's got that leadership vibe. He's got someone that he is young, but you could fall into line behind this guy.
Right.
And it was really great to just, it was just that moment. And I'll never forget it. Just clocking eyes with him and going, wow, that he is, he's got a presence. And that was him halfway down a carpet chatting to someone. It's like you could feel something about that. And I thought he did it. He was an excellent choice. You know, the accent was great. The presence was great. You know, you believe this man would be king and that he would be a popular king and one that would inspire people.
You know, it's so funny. We have all the Brits play our American superheroes, and apparently we have Americans play, you know, Scottish historical heroes. So, but I know I totally agree with you. I think, you know, like you, I've been following Chris Pine for a long time. I mean, gosh, I think the first thing I saw him in was Princess Diaries 2. Way yes. back in the day, you know, and so, but he's been somebody that I feel like has grown on me more and more and more as an actor that I really respect. And I think that that's because he does such a great job of pouring himself into whatever role he's in and just portraying that person with as much humanity as possible. And I think he really does that in the role here, that he does exactly what you need to do. This man that is struggling with the choices that he's making. He's doing everything he can to free his country. He's portraying the weight of that burden that he's carrying for the murder he committed, for what he felt like he had to do. I'm also too, I mean, just a man who loses everything. He loses his castle. He loses his family. You know, and he has to find a way to make it through. And I think Chris Pine just, he makes you feel what he's feeling. And that's what you need in this role, because you don't want this man to be a Superman. You want this man to be a human being. And the moment that really got to me was the moment where he watches one of his brothers die on the river as they're trying to cross over on the boat. and he's rowing back, and the determination and just the anguish on his face is just like, that was the moment for me where I was just like, really, I felt like they chose the perfect actor for this role.
100%.
It's really interesting, and I the movie does a decent job, although James Douglas will be and is the closest ally to Robert the Bruce. But Aaron Taylor Johnson is a good actor, but I enjoyed him in this role, although I don't feel like in the movie he's as big as what I read that he is historically.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, he really is, he's Bruce's right-hand man, and next to his brothers, the person he trusts the most throughout the rest of his life. They're inseparable in the sense of commitment to one another. So I feel like he does a good job for what he's given to do, but I felt like the role could have been accentuated even more.
I mean, I must admit, and I think it's a discussion I've had with quite a few people, that he's become almost a lot of people's kind of favorite character in the movie, because he is such a almost a primal character in a way. And I think like there's so many moments like, and I think I've watched this movie on obviously a big screen and at kind of home as well, and it lacks a little bit of an impact on kind of the TV screens. But just before this big final battle, it cuts to him, and you just see him. It's more, you can just pick up perfectly on a big screen, but he's frothing at the mouth with kind of excitement and just the anger to just really get stuck into kind of fighting the English. And I think he's just one of these characters that he is such a big player, but kind of within the confines of this movie, it has been sort of reduced. But I think he becomes someone, this character that people just really enjoy, and they see him and they go, yeah, I can understand that dislike, you know, that kind of rivalry you probably see in Scottish football fans when we're playing England or in kind of those kind of sporting events. Yes. Or politics. He is just someone that people go, oh yeah, I know a James Douglas, and yeah, that James Douglas reminds me of my pal from work, or that guy I know from something, or oh, he's my mate on the terraces. He is someone that I think a lot of Scots are really relating to, and he's almost become a bit of a kind of the star of the movie for a lot of people, I think.
It's funny you're mentioning that, because I was listening to an interview that Peter Jackson did about his new documentary for the World War One, which I'm really hoping I get a chance to see. It's got a couple of days. It's going to be in the theaters here for special engagements. And I really want to see it. But he was mentioning how the front lines in World War One, they rotated the men in and out. So they weren't in the trenches all the time. They would rotate in and out. And anytime the Scots rolled in, like, no, the Germans didn't want to have anything to do with the Scots. They were deathly afraid of the Scots. So what you're saying is absolutely true. Like, Douglas is a man of just high ferocity and not somebody you want to go up against. And so, yeah, I do think in those moments, he does do a good job of really showing that and bringing that to life when he gets the opportunity. So, well done on him, I think. The most interesting thing I'd say this, you know, Florence Pugh playing Elizabeth, which is his second wife, it was very interesting to me that in the movie they chose to have this be more of an arranged marriage, whereas in history, he falls in love with her and they get married and there isn't anything arranged about it. So that was an interesting take for me to see them use in the film, but historically that's not necessarily the case. Although, regardless, I think she does a really good job in the role, and she makes the most of every time she's on screen.
Yeah, I think she's an actress that people are going to become a lot more familiar with in the kind of the coming years. That I think a couple of years ago she was wonderful in Lady Macbeth. I don't know if it's on Amazon Prime in America, but it certainly is here. And it's not based on the Macbeth storyline at all, but she plays a young woman in sort of a period piece that is, you know, is trying to, you know, and is kind of trapped in an arranged marriage of her own. And she is fantastic in it. She is one of these brilliant leading actors. And I think she's kind of coming up in a new TV series. I think she's going to be someone that people are going to be seeing a lot more of. Sort of Lady Macbeth was the movie where people were seeing it. And then after that, she's kind of getting cast in a lot of these films. And I would love to have seen more of her in this film. I think she's fantastic. And, you know, it's those little scenes as well when the English are coming and, you know, they're dragging this young boy, and she's like, you know, my father is, you know, in command of this army. He wants men to fight, not children. And it's just like, you get a real, it's another thing I liked about this movie and the character as well. And, you know, you don't deserve points for it, but it was nice to see sort of that kind of Robert the Bruce as a man, that he is put into this arranged marriage in the film, but they don't consummate it on the night. You know, they almost learn to fall in love with each other. And there's never sort of her, he's always very respectful of her being thrown into this position. And it almost seems that, you know, she earns his respect and likewise. And I think they're a really good pairing. I just wish that was the one thing I wish I'd seen more of. Maybe not so much the history element, but these two had a really good partnership.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think and they have great chemistry on screen, and I really enjoyed the way that they did portray it in the movie, in the sense of just them getting to know each other and kind of finding their way to fall in love with each other, with the whole aspect of making it kind of more of an arranged marriage. And, you know, I thought it was fascinating because, and historically too, for her, because she is the daughter of one of the English captains and one of the most important people to Edward, the first, the King of England, it's fascinating because that's the only thing that saves her from actually, in the movie, they portray her as having been locked up in one of those cages, hanging down from the battlements on a castle. That's actually not what happens to her because of who her father is. If she had been anybody else, that's exactly what they would have done to her. But she's under house arrest for, I think, a little over 9 years. So it's a very long time that they're apart. It's still awful for her, but she doesn't get treated the way they show her getting treated in the movie. I think they do that in the movie because they wanted you to see what did happen to people in the court of the Bruce, because a couple of women actually do have that happen to them. And one of the women actually survives that for 4 years. Wow. And the only person that she speaks to through that whole time is the woman who brings her food every day. Like, I don't know how that's possible, but it's insane.
Certainly not civilized times.
No, definitely not. There'd be some lawsuits these days, you know? So was there anybody else in the cast for you that, you know, beyond these three really stuck out to you?
Yeah, definitely for two of them, Billy Howell as Edward, kind of Prince of Wales. He's an actor I wasn't too familiar with until this year, really. He's fantastic in the adaptation of On Chesil Beach. He plays what could be the total opposite.
I haven't seen that yet, and I love that book, so I need to see that.
Really, really good film, and he's fantastic in it as this sort of dithering kind of English gentleman and man trying to find his way in the world. And he's very much an English man trying to find his way in the world in this. And he is just a brilliant villain. Like, you immediately, when they're having this sword fight, and it's that really sort of passive aggressive, you know, mm-hmm. they're dueling and they're, yep. you know, the barbs are kind of going there with the, like, they're almost kind of chuckling away as they kind of, you know, give each other some passive aggressive comments. And just like the whole bit when his father dies, and it's like, you know, I never cried because I knew it scared you. And, you know, he just blows off his father's, you know, wishes. I just thought he was really, really good in this film. And the same with Tony Curran as well. He's a man that's literally starred in everything. And he's also been in another Netflix movie this year based in Scotland, Caliber, which is, you know, a very dark movie as well, but one of my highlights of the year. He is always fantastic in this. And mm-hmm. I just love the sort of the rival, the the banter really between him and Black Douglas when they're talking. It's like, you know, if you go near my daughter again, I'm going to chop off your nether regions and I'm going to use it as bait. And I just think he's an excellent character. He's someone that he's just a quiet, calming presence around Robert the Bruce. And I just thought he was excellent. I just think it's a really well cast film, and it was one that, you know, there are really great castings kind of gone into this movie, and I think they've really picked the best people for these roles.
Yeah, I agree with you on both counts. I think they were wonderful in the roles that they had. You know, I've always enjoyed Tony Curran when I've seen him, and I just looked on Chesil Beaches on Amazon Prime, so I'll be able to watch
awesome.
It soon. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing Billy Howell in that. But yeah, I mean, the almost psychopathic nature that he kind of plays the Prince of Wales with is fiercely disturbing. You know, that he is somebody who's just frothing at the mouth for victory and to defeat the Bruce and to subjugate this country. You know, it's kind of scary the way he plays it, and I think it's perfect. You know, you want I think you do get a little bit more black and white in that sense, you know, of the characterizations, but historically he is a man who is obsessed, as his father was, with trying to subjugate Scotland for his entire life. It does seem to be an obsession with him. So I felt like they did a really good job of portraying that.
He is just a mad man.
Yes,
I think it's something that you kind of see a lot with kind of English history, really, because, like, you know, you think of for a country like the kind of UK and, you know, the size of England, like, the old saying, like, kind of the sun's never set on kind of the English Empire. And I think that's been something that's been there through English history, where they've gone to all these places from America to Africa to Australia, and they have gone in with this attitude that we should be subversive to these, you know, this nation. And it's a nation that is unrelatable to many of these kind of people. And for such a small nation, that kind of, that power, that arrogance has, that, you know, it helped them kind of conquer the globe. And, you know, they owned most of the world until even just a few decades ago. And it was that kind of attitude, that kind of Prince of Wales attitude, that really helped them do it, I think.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. You know, and seeing a movie like this, I think it does a great job of bringing home some of those things. And as we talked about earlier, just a story that we haven't seen as much of, but now we're really, I hope that this will really bring to light this history in a way that makes people want to, you know, watch it more often, and not only that, but just like see more things about this. I think it would be fascinating, and read more books about it. You know, the book I have by Ronald McNair Scott, I think, I'm looking right now. You know, this book came out in 1989. And so this is, you know, it's not something you get a lot of books written about. So I think maybe this movie, if it can spur people on towards looking back at some of this history, it would be really fascinating. 'Cause I'd love to see more books on it. I wanted to ask you too, you know, this is always really important, but this being such a huge Scottish production, what did you end up thinking about the production value of the film?
It was unbelievable. I mean, I think they spent about 90 million on this movie, and you see every penny of it on the screen. That what I love is that everything is so tactile, that, you know, when they're in the ocean, when they're in the mud, you feel every single one of those. And I just thought it looked, you know, the country looked great. I mean, I thought it looked fantastic on a TV. I thought it looked brilliant on a, you know, an IMAX screen. I just thought it was like, you were blown away by the quality of it, because we're so used to in Scotland, you know, you maybe get the odd bit of a scene here. You know, you had something like The Avengers. You know, they shot here, you know, it looks great on a big screen. But like, this looked brilliant. You know, I think it's that passion of having Scottish people involved in making this movie that they want. They know the locations to go to. They know the angles to shoot at. They probably had this story in their head their entire life. And I think you see it. Every little scene of that, you know, the armor looks fantastic. You know, the battle sequences, you know, the big cannon thing that they fire at Stirling Castle. Like, you look at that and you think, that is, they've really used every single penny of that. And, you know, 90 million is nothing to be sniffed at. That is a lot of money. And I look at that and I think, awesome. I'm very curious as well. I know that between sort of Toronto Film Festival when it was originally put out there, there is extra footage. There's like 25 minutes that was cut between then and when I saw it in London kind of a couple weeks earlier, which includes like an extra kind of battle scene and Robert the Bruce and William Wallace meeting up kind of early in the movie as well. So I'd love to kind of see that extra material someday. I know that was a bit of a hard process for them, cutting out those scenes, because they looked great. You know, they had spent quite a bit of money on it, but they felt it didn't kind of fit in with the film and making it work as best it could. So I'd love to see those extra values as well. But I'm curious as well for an American, and when I was telling a friend earlier, I was like, I'm gonna be discussing with this with an American. He's like, I'd love to hear what an American thinks of this. So what was your kind of take on the production, and do you feel that with a movie like this where it's going all around the world, you know, it's from here to America to Iceland, everywhere in between, would this inspire people to come visit Scotland? Does it change people's opinion of us as a nation?
Well, I mean, I can say, you know, hearty hell yeah. I would, if I could afford it, I would drop everything and go to Scotland in a heartbeat. You know, just part of, but you're talking to somebody who's always wanted to visit this country. And, you know, it's, I think, The thing that they did so well was just some of the aerial landscape shots where you get to see the expanse and beauty of Scotland was very smart, because Scotland is a beautiful country. It's so photogenic, you know, whether it's foggy or sunny. I mean, it's kind of a country that looks good in any weather. And I think they do such a great job of finding the ways to shoot this, like you were saying, just in the right light with the right angles to make it optimum awesome. So that every time that you're in a new environment, you're feeling that environment. Like, I loved that, you know, I felt like the way that they kind of shot the parts on the islands, when they go to the islands, was a little bit different than some of the angles and shots that they would use in other parts of the film. So it made each place kind of come to life in a different way. And it really brought home the wild beauty that is Scotland. And so, yes, absolutely. As an American, I would visit this place in a heartbeat, and I think I would enjoy and relish every minute of it, because there is such a raw, powerful beauty to the landscape of Scotland. And then, you know, I think you're absolutely right. The production value with every other part of the film, you never felt like this was a movie that just belonged on the small screen, you know, and that's the way I saw it. But I mean, I would have paid to see this on the big screen if it had come out in theaters here. So yeah. I think Scotland did themselves proud with this film and the production of it. And I would hope to see, you know, maybe them do some more films like this, because I would be delighted to watch more of them.
I think one of the complaints people have had is that it could be more like, you know, like they could have a Robert the Bruce story that goes on for further, you know, a further decade and furthermore. But I think the fact that they've, you know, they really focused on kind of the War of the Bruce period, like, it does potentially leave open up a further door that, you know, you could kind of have more stories about Bruce and Black Douglas and, you know, the Allies and their war against the English and, you know, their many adventures that they kind of went on. Mm-hmm. I think, like, there is an avenue for that to kind of happen again in the future. Whether they do it, I wouldn't think so, but it's always kind of possible. And I want to say one thing as well, that with that kind of, one thing that I think might surprise international audiences, and I think would surprise many Americans, because I know how kind of you know, big they take it. Scotland doesn't technically have a national anthem. We have a shared national anthem with the rest of the United Kingdom of God Save the Queen. But Scotland, whenever they're playing, like, you know, an international football match or a sporting event or so on, we sing O Flower of Scotland, which is all about this war of Robert the Bruce and sending kind of Edward home to think again, you know, of daring to kind of come up against the Scots. And that whenever we go into sporting events and so on and we sing this song, this is like, this movie is, you know, evoking what we kind of sing about when we're talking about our country and what it could potentially be in the future of an independent nation, if that's what some people want it to be, and so on. It's just a fascinating thing, you know. Not many people know that we don't have an anthem, but this movie is the song that we sing about at these games instead.
That's awesome. That's fascinating. It's because, especially since I think just a few, as we're recording this, a couple weeks ago, the Scottish women's national team was playing the U.S. women's national team. And so I heard them sing that song. That's really funny. I did not know that.
And now you know the context of it.
That's awesome. Well, and it's funny because, you know, for us as Americans, our national anthem is very much rooted in a specific point in history, you know. So in many ways, what you would sing there before a sporting event is the same for us. So that's really fascinating that we have a similarity in that way. So
yeah, absolutely.
Well, that, you know, you raised an interesting question that I kind of wanted to ask you, because if there is anything about this movie that I do feel like isn't quite perfect, it's that I do think that it could be longer. And no, I'm not talking about Little Pine. I had to make the joke. It had to be done. But I do feel like this movie, that there, you know, it's, I think, a little over 2 hours, just a tiny bit over, you know, a smidge over 2 hours. And I feel like maybe an extra 30 minutes or, you know, heck, I could sit there for another hour, honestly. I feel like it does feel a little bit rushed.
I think it's interesting because there definitely was that cut, that it was something that, you know, only existed, you know, less than a month and a half ago. There was that extra kind of 30 minutes. So, you know, you can find out online about that extra scenes that have kind of been lost in the cut. And it's interesting because I could easily watch another half an hour or an hour of this movie. But it's interesting that the movie we've got, which is getting quite fantastic reviews, you know, there's the odd middling review, but it seems a really positive one. I think if you were a Rotten Tomatoes subscriber, you would say it's a fresh movie. And people were kind of saying that when they saw it in Toronto, that, you know, the director's watching it going, something's not right here. He was feeling, the audience wasn't kind of getting into the movie quick enough. He could feel that there was issues. And, you know, before the UK premiere, within 3 weeks, they had removed 25 minutes of that movie and the reviews spiked up from that point. So I think it's one of these ones that there could be a case for more, but the more that we might have actually got might have made it kind of a lesser film. And you know, an interesting bit of trivia for people, and, you know, Braveheart is you know, a movie that is very much associated with Scottish nationalism, and we mean kind of Scottish nationalism very different to what might be associated in other places in the world. It's, you know, it's very much about kind of pride in your country and, you know, viewing it as you'd like it to be independent one day. And Braveheart is very much associated with that film, whereas they've been at pains with Outlaw King to say this isn't going to be that type of movie. We're playing to a universal audience. But one change did happen, a further change, where at the end, where it's like, you know, in the future and in 300 years, Scotland and England united. When I saw it at London, it said Scotland and England united in 300 years, blah, 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 dot, dot, dot. But that's another story. And it was very much a wink and a nod to sort of, you know, what's going on kind of here in the UK these days. And it played very much, the audience certainly laughed to it. But they have removed that line in the past 3 weeks, you know, with this movie. So there's certainly changes and other cuts out there of this movie. But I think the reviews of what we've got kind of maybe showed that we're lucky that maybe less is more, perhaps, in this way.
Yeah, it. I think, you know, part of it is always going to be what you're going to add. And so, you know, I do think for me, part of it was reading the historical accounts and seeing that there is a lot more to the story and wanting some more of that. So, you know, it would be fascinating to me that, it, you know, since it's on Netflix, you know, if they did ever release like the extended version on Netflix to allow you to be able to see that and just see how it plays. You know, in the end, you know, I think speaking as an American, you know, I do think this, along with Braveheart, does kind of have a good sense of patriotism. That's what I would. I don't really appreciate the words nationalism either, because I think it does speak to some other things. But I do think that there is an importance for having good patriotism for your country, and like you said, having a pride in your country, you know, and your history, and part of being a good patriot for your country is actually knowing its history. And so, you know, movies like this, I think, are important to be able to hopefully spike interests in that. And honestly, in the end, too, look, for me, I've always loved historical films because, you know, if we forget the past, we're just going to repeat it. You know, it's a tropey saying for a reason, because it happens all the time. And, you know, being able to look back at history in this way, I think, is important. And any film that can inspire history like this, and like, I, you know, I went and read a whole book about it. I love that, you know, and so I hope that we see more films like this. And I think they've done themselves, you know, Scotland should be very proud of its history in this way. So if you, Lee, for you, where would you come down kind of in a ranking in this? Maybe, you know, out of 5, out of 10, what do you think Outlaw King does rate for you?
I'm going to be a bit of a cop out here. I'm going to go with 2 ratings. And I remembered, you know, I saw this with amongst like 30 other films at London Film Festival. And this was one of the ones that I, you know, there was other movies that I enjoyed, like I liked and loved more as a fan of cinema. But I came out of this like, I would give that a 4.5 for an absolute and enjoyable movie. It was one that I thought had great pacing. It was well acted. It made me feel, you know, excited. And that's something that I think is a bit of a struggle these days. You know, you think of something like an Infinity War, for example. I know they're totally wildly different, but this was a movie, you know, that was a movie all about, you know, a foe and rising up and, you know, a big battle at the end. And, you know, it's good. But like, this was something about it where it's like, oh man, this is like proper old school. It's a good romp, and I would give it a 4.5 just for that enjoyment. And you know, it's been 2 months nearly since I've seen it, and I'm still talking about it, enjoying it, you know, talking with other people, and you know, I'm hearing people that are seeing it here in Edinburgh in the cinema, and people are applauding at the end. And me and you have discussed this before, British and Scottish audiences are poker face in cinemas. They, you know, they'll laugh along at the jokes, but it is not an interactive thing. The last film I remembered anyone applauding was at the end of Les Miserables. So that gives you a kind of a point here. So people are really connecting with it. So I give it a 4.5 for enjoyability. You know, objectively, I would give it a 4 out of 5, but it's probably one of the most fun times I've had at the cinema this year. And I'm glad that there's a movie like this where I feel excited to talk about it. You know, I've done, you know, I've interviewed the cast, I've spoken about it on my own podcast, and I'm still enjoying talking about it with someone else and hearing their different points of view. So I think that's definitely a testament to the film. And I think David McKenzie and co have done a great job. What about yourself?
Yeah, I think you're right on. You know, David McKenzie, Hell or High Water is just a brilliant film. It was one of my favorite films a few years ago that I had seen. And so to see him come and do this with Chris Pine, who he had worked so well with in Hell or High Water, I think they put out just a complete winner. You know, this is just a proper good historical romp. I think it has all the hallmarks that you want of a film trying to tell a historical story in an interesting and inviting way to bring you in to the world, and the acting is fantastic. As we talked about, the production value of it is incredible. Again, the only thing I'd say is I would love more of the story, and maybe that's good. Maybe it's good to leave you wanting more. So like I was mentioning earlier, it leads people to go get books and read, you know, and do some study about the history of this. So all in all, I think you're absolutely right. I'd say this is a good 4 out of 5 stars. And the fact that, you know, all around the world, you can see this on Netflix, there's no reason not to watch it, you know. And we didn't even really talk about it, but, you know, gosh, even the battle sequences are just really well done. They're so intense, and you feel like you're in the middle of them. And in some ways that's good, and in some ways it's not, because they're so, there's such a visceral nature to them. But I think that's good, as you see the reality of what life was like back then and what people did, what they went through for freedom. And so I think that it's a really important thing to be thinking about and talking about these days, you know, that when we look at this idea of something so big and important as the idea of freedom, you know, it's never free. So, and we see that here, and I think they do a great job with it. So I highly recommend 2 thumbs up from both Lee and I for Outlaw King. And I hope everybody will go check it out. Like I said, if you haven't seen it, gosh, especially if you're here in the States and all around the world, we've got it on Netflix. So do check it out. I want to say a huge thank you to Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, Daniel Noah, and Ryan Millett for their support of the network and specifically the 602 Club through Patreon. They are the associate producers here through Patreon, and they know that this network cannot do this on its own. It's too big of an enterprise to put together Track FM and all the shows we have coming out. So if you would like to support the network and make sure all of that keeps coming to you each and every week, as so many podcasts are coming to you each and every week, go to patreon.com/trekfm and you can see how you can be part of the team. There are different contribution levels that you can give at, but in the end, every little bit helps. So every little bit a month, make sure that this keeps coming to you. So again, that's patreon.com/trekfm, where you can support us. Lee, it was great to have an actual Scot on to talk about such an important film for the Scottish people. And man, I know you have you know, been able to interview the cast, and you've got your own podcast and everything. So let everybody know where they can find you so they can catch up on some of the stuff that you did about Outlaw King.
Yeah, you can catch me on The Nerd Party Like Yourself and on The Filibuster Strand. So I got to interview kind of Tony Curran, Chris Pine, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, the producer, James Cosmo. So I was a very, very lucky man. So I count my lucky stripes for that. So you can hear my red carpet interviews with them there and some of my reviews and so on there. So yeah, you can find me there. And I've got a new podcast that's just sort of come out in the past week or so called The A24 Project. We'll be discussing another Scottish film soon, Under the Skin. But that's been a real treat, and we were lucky to have a wee cameo appearance from yourself in episode 3. So the Matt Rushing cinema, the podcast universe continues. So yeah, you can find me on those podcasts on the Nerd Party for sure.
Awesome. Where are you on Twitter as well?
Oh yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Lee_Nostromo.
Awesome. And thank you so much for the clip too that you allowed us to use there at the very beginning of the show. You heard a clip of Lee interviewing the one and only ridiculously handsome Chris Pine. So appreciate you letting us use that. That was a real treat to be able to hear, man. And gosh, I can't even imagine how cool that would have been.
It was scary, because I'll give you a small behind the scenes story. You know, I'm sure your listeners are ready for a cup of tea at this point, but when they were doing the red carpet, like originally it was like, right, you'll get 3 questions each with these people, 2 questions, 1 each. And then it was all kind of running late, because these things always drag on. And like they coupled a lot of this, the online press, together and went, right, it's 1 question between the lot of you. And you're sitting there thinking, like, this is my moment. Like, I'm not going to let this slide. And he just came right in the bang in front of me. And it was just like, microphone. So, Chris, and it was just one of those moments you're like, if I don't do this, one of the other publications are. And I'm, as a kind of fan of these things, like, I wasn't going to let that slide. I was updating you guys in the Nerd Party group chat at the time. I was like, oh my God, Chris Pine's here. I'm going to go for it. And it was, yeah, it was a real moment. That was a real treat. And I can assure people that he was a genuinely lovely guy. I mean, you don't hear it in the clip, but like just a few seconds before, like the crowd were screaming for him, like, Chris. And he's like, I'm sorry, guys, I've got to work right now. And he's just, not many people do that. He's a great guy. We're really lucky to have him as an ambassador for Star Trek and for places like kind of Trek FM. You know, he's one of our own in a way as well. So we're very lucky.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Well, you can find me doing not so cool things over on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram and Letterboxd under the same name. I am here on the network when we get a chance. Chris Jones and I talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine on The Orb. I'm also, as Lee mentioned, on the Nerd Party. I've got a couple shows there. One is called Owl Post with Drea Kaufman, as we talk about Harry Potter each and every week. And, of course, you would have heard us recently on the 602 Club here talking about Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. And then I am doing, of course, Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, which is a Star Wars podcast. And each and every week, we just dive into a topic that we've been thinking about. In that Star Wars franchise. So it's a lot of fun. Check that out. And then last but not least, doing cinema stories with my good friend Courtney as we talk about films, but through the lens of faith. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now. You're here. ¶¶